Thursday afternoon, and we're going to have a one bill before us today, which is Senate Bill 1087. And so I'm going to go ahead and open at this point a public hearing on Senate Bill 1087. And, Council, why don't you give us a brief overview of the concepts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 4 amendments in front of you, and they replace the bill which you have in Section 1. And this is a referral as it's currently written to the voters. And you have in Section 1 the findings and declarations. Section 2, which you have the provisions relating to people dealing in substantial quantities of certain illegal drugs, including heroin, methamphetamines, cocaine, and ecstasy. And what it does is if you have over a certain amount of those drugs, you get 58 months to 38 months, depending on your past criminal history. If you have under that amount but above another certain amount, usually 100 grams, depending on the substance, or 50 grams if it is heroin, you get a penalty of 34 to 72 months, depending on your criminal history. So, Chair, members of the committee, what this is designed to do is reach those offenders who are dealing in drugs who are not normally picked up by the federal government and prosecuted in federal court. This will give a tool to law enforcement because currently many of these people would have the option of probation. And these oftentimes are people that are mules bringing drugs up here from out of state. And this will give a leverage for law enforcement to use to help convince these people to cooperate. Section 3 is similar to that in the sense that this relates to delivery to minors and incarceration from 34 to 72 months. But there is a provision in here so it does not pick up other minors that there are of a three-year age difference. So if you're 19 and given to a 16 or a 17-year-old, you wouldn't be picked up by this. But if you're 21, given to a 16-year-old, you would. Then in Section 4, we have a provision relating to an increased penalty where the victim, it's aggravated theft, meaning it's over $10,000, and the victim is 65 years of age. This was a suggestion from one of the units in the Multnomah District Attorney's Office because of people who prey on people over 65 years of age with various schemes. And one of the underlying themes here is that these people at this age have a difficulty. If someone 24, 25 is hit for $10,000, that's bad enough. But they have a lifetime to recuperate. And someone 65, oftentimes it's their retirement money, and it makes it difficult for them to do so. You then have a definition as it relates in Section 4A of the different ecstasy. It's defined in this chemical term, and a mixture of substance means any mixture, et cetera. That's current law. And then the Section 5 is what we have is the repeat property offender. Currently under certain provisions of the repeat property offender, if it's second offense and certain serious offenses, you have a mandatory sentence of 19 months. That's going to 24 months. And then other provisions where it would be four or more, the current version says two or more, and the penalty there would be 19 months. That's an increase from current law, too, on the penalties. Then you have other languages. Now let me go over to Section 6. This is the provision that relates to treatment, and it basically would establish a grant program. The Department of Corrections will provide appropriate treatment not only for people within the institution, but make grants to counties to supplement treatment, and also jail beds that would be tied into treatment. Evidence and research has shown that treatment, particularly which tied to jail beds with the ability to have swift and certain sanctions, shows very positive results. We then go beyond that, and then this has definitions as it relates to property crime and drug-addicted persons, intensive supervision, what it means. And then going over Section 9, it ties it into as much as possible to the Criminal Justice Commission, because you go back to the first section, there's a range based on the criminal justice history. But you can't go outside that range. There will be no departing downward. There will be ability to depart upward, but not downward. And then finally, the other sections in Section 11 is a section that basically says that if two initiatives on the ballot, Initiative Petition 40 is on the ballot, and this petition is on the ballot at the same time, there is a degree that they conflict to a certain degree. But to make certain that we only have one of those provisions, this would be a provision that said the initiative with the most votes goes into effect. The other goes into effect and is then repealed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a rough overview of the bill.
All right. And just, I'm going to start off with that Section 11. That is what I'm going to be referring to, the either-or clause. And that makes it very clear that the voters would be making a decision if we had two competing measures on the ballot, that whichever of the two prevailed with the highest number of votes, that it would be controlling as to what would be implemented, with the other one not being implemented. And because of the suggestions of legislative council, it would in fact be enacted, but automatically would be repealed. With that, I want to also put on the record that there's been a number of interest groups that have been meeting as a larger work group and then as some splinter subcommittee or sub-work groups over the last 2 weeks or so. And those groups are still have been narrowed to some level and are still meeting. And we're going to be taking public taking invited testimony at first as to the framework of what we have been working on that includes in rough form the Dash Force. But for committee members, I can assure you that as we move forward, there will be other changes that are not reflected in the Dash 4 based on where the work groups have been heading. So with that said, we have a number of people who've listed on the witness registration that want to give testimony. Representative Greg McPherson is here. I know that he has many other obligations, so we're going to let Representative McPherson go first, and then we'll start picking up panels of different individuals and groups. Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg McPherson, representing House District 38 in Lake Oswego and Lower Southwest Portland. I am a member of the work group that's developed the legislation that's currently reflected in Senate Bill 1087-4, the Dash 4 amendments. The central problem that we're trying to deal with here, both in this legislation and in the Initiative Petition 40, is the problem of drug addiction in our state. We have people who become addicted to drugs, and then in order to feed that habit, they commit drug crimes, that is, dealing drugs to others, manufacturing in some cases, or they steal the property of other Oregonians in order to feed that habit. And it is drug addiction that is behind a very high proportion of the repeated property crimes that go on in Oregon. We have an Initiative Petition 40 that has been proposed to the people with signatures already submitted that would respond to this by putting in place a system of mandatory minimum sentences with no funding source for it. So it would be a large unfunded mandate for that would fall on the state general fund. And it borrows from the strategy that you see in the federal so-called war on drugs, which is to lock up more people for a longer period of time. Well, the federal war on drugs, I don't think anybody would claim that that's been a success in that strategy. And so what we need to do in Oregon is to be smart on crime, not just tough on crime. What we need to do is to protect the public by locking up some people for a longer period of time where they repeatedly prey on other Oregonians, and that's reflected in the legislation that's evolving in the Dash 4 amendments. But we also need to provide treatment dollars so that we address the underlying addiction, because until we break out of that cycle, we will not have really be protecting the public. We will have people who go in and out of incarceration and continue to prey on the public. So what these amendments are designed to do is to provide those treatment dollars and to hold offenders who don't undergo the treatment successfully accountable for that failure. So in that way, it separates them from society for a time and then provides a pathway so they can get clean and stay clean. So I think this legislation is on the right track in providing that treatment course of action, which will ultimately be the only way we break people out of this cycle of addiction. But it also holds offenders who are repeatedly preying on other Oregonians and stealing their property accountable for their action. It's obviously a work in progress, and I welcome the work that the stakeholders have brought forward. They've presented some good ideas to us already that need to be reflected in this legislation, but I think that this is the right course, and that offering up a a good, smart alternative to the public with the either-or clause that was described here a couple of minutes ago is the right way to go. So I would urge your work on this bill, because I think it's important legislation for this session, and ultimately it's something we must do for the benefit of Oregonians to move some version of this bill out to the public. Well, those are all my remarks. I would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for the representative? Greg, thank you very much.
You're good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to go ahead and start with some of the groups that have been meeting as part of a larger work group or subgroups. And I'd like to go ahead and start with Oregon District Attorneys Association, Kevin Neely, and John Foote.
Good afternoon, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is John Foote, and I serve as the Clackamas County District Attorney and have also the pleasure of working within the ODAA here in Oregon. As you know, Oregon's district attorneys have been working for quite a while now, over a year, to try and find a cost-effective alternative for repeat property offenders here in Oregon that makes sense for the public and for victims and is cost-effective, knowing that there's going to be a choice in the fall. So we are still committed to that, and we have very much appreciated the efforts of the legislature and yourself, Chair, to try and find that path, and the governor's office, and everyone else involved. Our preferred approach here is an enactment in the session, but we understand it's a complicated path, and we'll work on alternatives if that is not possible. But as you know, that's still what we'd like to see this end in the session and move forward with solutions that help this problem. So we're here to answer any questions you have. We appreciate your all your help and support. I think we're close on many principles, and we're committed to trying to resolve the rest as quickly as possible. So thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, I don't think I can add much to that. Again, I think as it
Except
relates...
your name, maybe.
Oh, I am Kevin Neely, and I do represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Apparently, I didn't want to own up to it just then. but that being said, I think that the principles enumerated in Senate Bill 1087, the amended version that you see in front of you, these are, again, things we have been working very hard on, and perhaps in their entirety, and certainly in large part, we endorse what's in here. It's a good policy, as Representative Prusansky, or as Representative McPherson said earlier. It really does address an absolutely critical issue in Oregon, which is repeat property offenses. We want to find a solution, and again, I'm very optimistic that we're on the path to do that.
Great, thank you. Questions, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This measure would not have the kind of fiscal impact that the Mannix measure would have, but it does have a fiscal impact of some note that is not included in anybody's budget, in anybody's funding mechanism. So if this or the Mannix proposal, and the Mannix proposal has an impact of up to $200 million a year, according to the Criminal Justice Commission, if this money has to come from within the public safety system, where could you see it coming? Since this is a high priority with you all, what is a lower priority that you could eliminate or reduce to produce the money for this program?
Chair, Senator Burke, I try and follow a very practice of not goring somebody else's ox and suggesting where other people can lose things. I try and stick to what I can control. So I don't have that answer. And I'm not suggesting that is necessarily the answer. We're hoping in the long run this measure saves money by reducing crime and producing fewer victims and fewer harm. We're hopeful of that. That's the spirit in which we proposed it. There's a treatment component, which is designed to try and help people to change their behavior and there's an accountability component if they don't. And we think that's the right approach, but we do recognize it costs money. I think it's clear from the polling that the public wants something done, and it's a priority for them. So the trick is, what's the most cost-effective way to do it? And that's what we've tried to find, and that works and costs as little as possible. And I'm sorry I can't give you more specifics than that, but that's really my best faith answer. I wouldn't presume to know where the money would come from. I don't know. I'm not in that seat.
Unfortunately, I am.
I recognize that.
Any other questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank
you. Just one. Thank you. Gentlemen, certainly this is going to have a major cost to government. Have you done any work to determine how much savings it might have to the private sector in reduction in property loss, reduction in victimhood, reduction in other bad things that occur to people when they get robbed and burgled and thefted and so forth?
Chair, Senator, what's it? No, we have not. Obviously, those are not really within our resources. But it also, I think, may result in a healthier business climate, which has effects for everybody, jobs. And, you know, we all know that. If the community is safer and healthier, then there are all sorts of repercussions, and it's hard to put a cost on that. And we're not really the ones who could do that. So, sorry, we don't have the number for you. I'm full of non-answers right at the moment. I apologize for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next panel I'm going to call up will be Ro Ramirez, representing the Oregon Sheriff's Association, and Dave Nelson, Oregon's Chief of Police. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Raul Ramirez, Executive Director of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As you've heard testimony with regards to the concerns around property crimes, certainly having legislation that addresses this. Our effort at the enforcement corrections level is how do we reduce the victimization out there, especially when you have repeat offenders, and it is out of control when you look at property crimes. This type of legislation certainly addresses that, having enhanced penalties. But also the issue is more than just accountability. If we have an expectation to turn that problem around and expect individuals to eventually work out of the system, that involves treatment, and this accompanies enhanced treatment. We recognize that warehousing offenders is not the solution. The issue is we need to continue to be tough on crime. Oregonians expect us to protect them. But at the same time, you have to have the right resources to turn an individual around, particularly those that are addicted. So this brings a lot of hope with regards to addressing that issue of property offenders, repeat property offenders in the state of Oregon. And we're here to work with the legislature on this issue and look forward to that.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Nelson. I'm currently Chief of Troutdale, and I'm representing OACP. I'm the immediate past president of OACP. My comments will probably be fairly brief. I don't want to repeat them. OACP is going to continue to work with the legislature and all of our crime partners in this. We strongly feel about tough on crime. We feel that property crimes are escalating. Our communities are hearing that. We see that. What we really support is the treatment component. There needs to be some form of treatment. We can't, as the sheriff said, we can't just continue to warehouse inmates and expect their behavior to change. All we're going to do is put inmates back out on the street when their prison sentence is over with no behavior modification. So we need to be able to treat them and change their behavior when they're released. We'll continue to work and support this measure however we can. We'd like to be able to participate as often as possible. So with that, I'll just address any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Question from the panel. Senator Robert.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is, if someone is incarcerated, is there any checks that we do to see that they're clean of drugs in the prisons?
Your question is in reference to the prisons. I couldn't answer that in regards to the prison, the jails. And again, Your question is, are there any checks with regards?
Well, yes. What I've heard through the grapevine is that when prisoners are incarcerated, that oftentimes illicit drugs are smuggled into them, and that say that you have a meth addict who needs to be clean about 18 months to get his dopamine down to a regular level or into a normal level, that while he's incarcerated, he still could be getting meth from the outside. Is there anything that as far as when they are incarcerated, are there any checks to make sure that they aren't getting illicit drugs while they are incarcerated?
Well, for the most part, the security and prevention of contraband coming into jail facilities is pretty stringent. I don't know of too many cases where, in fact, drugs have been smuggled into a jail setting. I can't speak of, you know, for the prisons, but that's something that we take very serious. And it's more infrequent than frequent with regards to that being a prevalent issue or concern in there.
Senator Garrod, I think Council Taylor has...
Chair, members of the committee, Senator Garrod, I talked to Scott Taylor, who will be testifying later. Scott is now head of community corrections in Multnomah County, but for 30 years was with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and he verified what I thought. For inmates within prison, there's random checks, your analysis, to check to see if they're on drugs. And also they have drug dogs who periodically go through the prisons.
Okay.
So they check that way. In fact, the other thing that's unusual about Oregon prisons, they don't allow smoking. So the drug of choice to get the prison is cigarettes.
And if I may add, at Marion County, we do have a canine that's a drug dog that goes through the jail. So as an example.
Any other question? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski. Gentlemen, there's been a study that's been has shown that in 2006 there was rather a sharp reduction in property crimes across the United States and in Oregon, and the study would indicate that during 2007 that has the property crimes have incidence has leveled off at that somewhat lower level. That is not what we have experienced in our more rural district, and I would ask if your experience has paralleled that study, or whether it would be different than that study.
From my experience, it would be different than that study. We're seeing an increase in property crimes, such as increase in car prowls, if you will, breaking in of cars. Identity thefts are continuing to be on a rise. That's what we're seeing, at least in, you know, I work in the East Multnomah County jurisdiction, and that's what we're seeing in that area, is a continued increase. So I think we're probably bucking the trends.
Yeah. I'm not sure where the trend came from, because it certainly doesn't. I haven't talked to anyone who's out in the field who's actually experienced that trend. Would you have a comment?
Well, the other aspect is those that are arrested and brought into correctional facilities. I'll just speak for Marion County. Our arrests have continued to increase and not decrease. So it's still a prevalent issue that we face.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
The next panel will be Scott Taylor, Commissioner Lisa Nato, and Paul Snyder.
Chair Pruszynski and the committee, Commissioner Nato has asked me to go first, so I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the director of the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm also here today representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. We've provided testimony from our president, Steve Berger, and from myself. For us, we've been invited to participate in the conversation around this bill, and we are very pleased and excited about it. It's already been discussed, but community corrections has been involved for quite some time with the offenders we are now discussing. On any given day, we supervise 34,000 offenders out in the community. And roughly 75% of those people have some relationship to substance abuse. We now are becoming more and more sophisticated in our ability to identify what are the underlying causes of their behavior and how we might address it. And with that kind of experience and with your passage of Senate Bill 267, which requires us to engage in evidence-based practices, we are becoming more and more confident that if we do not tie treatment to the accountability, if we don't have swift and certain accountability combined with treatment, that what we are doing is just spending a lot of time detaining people for some period of time and then they reengage. We have experienced in Multnomah County and elsewhere in the state significant improvement and reduction in recidivism by the engagement of people into treatment. So we're very pleased that the current bill in sections 6 and 7 has within it provisions to address these folks while they're in the community. As we've discussed before, under the current system in Senate Bill 1145, individuals come out into the community out of prison or off of probation. When they fail or revoke, they stay locally. They stay in our jails. They stay under our supervision. They don't come back to prison. So the costs and the ongoing maintenance of people that are failing retains in the counties to deal with. And we really appreciate the effort within this bill to hold people accountable at the front end who have earned their way into longer sentences and still give us the ability to deal with people and cut down on the recidivism and thus cut down on both the population flow and the damage to the community. We every day get to get the phone calls and deal with the victims, and we have the same concerns the district attorneys, the defense bar, the courts have about how can we, in fact, address this issue. We think that this bill starts down that road, gives us some ability to address that. It also, we believe, is cost effective in that it starts to actually, with that combination, we may begin to further address and stem the tide of the offenders we see that just cycle through. We find that this bill works that way. I think that's been our testimony to date. And as I said earlier, we're now using a statewide, we're using a tool that lets us start identifying what are the criminal factors that we can affect, and this is clearly one of them. In Multnomah County, I've been recently working on some initiatives, and we find at any given time I have 500 people sitting on a waiting list to get outpatient treatment, and I have 60 to 70 people sitting in the jail waiting to get into residential treatment. With the tools we use, I know that I'm meeting about one half or less of the need to address these folks, and those are folks currently on supervision. So we really think that you're heading in the right direction by continuing to fund and look at that combination of accountability and treatment, and we're supportive of that initiative. I guess the last thing I'd say is that we do know that 95% of these folks are going to return to your communities. They're going to be under our supervision. And we would appreciate the effort this bill makes to increase community safety through those effective interventions.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner. And I think it's sometimes difficult for elected officials to stand up and take positions on these types of measures because you don't want to be accused of being soft on crime. And I perhaps have a luxury because I'm term limited and I'm not running for anything, so I get to speak my mind pretty clearly. First, let me say my credentials, and I don't just put them out there to try to wow anyone, but I have a solid basis in public policy around public safety. I'm a former prosecutor. I've also served in the legislature, sat on judiciary committees. I have chaired our local public safety coordinating council for about 6 years, and that's the leaders of all the public safety entities in our community that come together to talk about how we can get people with mental illness out of our jails and prisons, how we can protect victims of domestic violence, how we can deal with overrepresentation of minorities in our public safety system, and other issues like that. I currently chair the National Association of Counties Public Safety and Justice Committee, and there you have people from all over the country coming together to discuss best practice about what works in changing people's behavior and making our community safer. Last year, I chaired the Association of Oregon County's Public Safety Committee, and so I really do have some background in this area. I was very concerned about the Mannix proposal. It has its cost is alarming. It has no proof to little proof of any effectiveness, other than for a short time while people are in custody, you do prevent crime at that time. And it purports to hold counties harmless, and yet counties are very concerned about the cutbacks that would be required in other programs to fund this proposal in building additional prisons. We're concerned about the cuts that might come to education, health care, and other human service programs. So it was with great pleasure, and I really appreciate the chair of this committee drawing together leaders at the state level in public safety to discuss alternatives and to really look at what works in terms of the public safety and prevention of crime. Any good public safety model has to have a collaboration of the system's partners. So I really think just focusing on incarceration just isn't going to work. You need community supervision. You need to fund the prosecution. You need to fund the public defender's office. And more importantly, the intersection of health, mental health, and addiction services are critical to moving forward and actually making any changes for our community. As Scott just said, people do come out. They come out of our jails. They come out of our prisons. And we need to change the results so that they don't just commit a crime and go right back in. We're all concerned about property crime. There's no question about that. And it's been very encouraging. I personally support the measures that you've put in to enhance penalties for the manufacturing and dealing of substances that affect our society, and also enhance penalties for those who prey on seniors. I think those are very good key provisions. But mostly I wanted to talk to you about the effectiveness of treatment. The evidence is clear that treatment works. Studies show that treatment reduces reoffense rates between 40 and 75% in the years following an intervention. In our county, we've invested in treatment, housing, and education, and employment preparation, and has reduced felony reconviction rates by 10% in the past decade. Still, 500 probationers and parolees lack treatment in our county, and between 40 to 70 jail inmates occupy cells each day. I get a report each week, and it ranges. I think this last week it was 67 people are sitting in our jails that could be released to a secure treatment facility, but there is none available. So they serve their time, they're released into the community, and what happens is exactly what you'd expect to happen. They commit another crime, and they come right back out. So people come back into the community and reoffend. I support your provisions to include treatment capacity to treat the underlying causes that drive this crime. Additional prevention could include early childhood investments, working with juveniles to turn their lives around, looking at our foster care system, because many of these people come out of a foster care system. They've been victims of abuse and neglect. And so all of these prevention areas, they're not partisan. They're not Democrat. They're not Republican. It's what works, and it's the right direction for us to go. So let's make prevention the focus of a real public safety proposal and support the alternatives. And as you work for this, I'm happy to work with you, but I think this is the right track. And I'm very encouraged today to hear from all the other public safety leaders, the Sheriff's Association, the District Attorneys, the Community Corrections Directors, that treatment works, and this is what we need. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Nato, if you would be so kind to just stay up.
Yeah, I was going to go ahead and let Mr. Snyder speak. And then
if, Paul, if you could just bring your chair over, that way we'll have a panel questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And one of the advantages of following Commissioner Nato, who used to chair, until very recently, our Public Safety Committee, is that it shortens my testimony substantially.
Mm-hmm.
And we just simply agree with the comments that have been made by Multnomah County. We think that a critical component of whatever package is brought forward should include treatment for the reasons that were very well outlined by Mr. Taylor and Commissioner Nato. Be pleased to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Wessett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Mr. Taylor, within the community corrections community, how long a period of post-release supervision is optimal to effectively reduce recidivism and to successfully return parolees to useful community life? That's one of the things that remains up in the air in the negotiations, and I'd like to hear on the record what you have to say about that.
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, I'll give it a run. I think what we're learning is that as we use these risk tools and we look at our recidivism rates and we start to target down who and what it is, it's not necessarily by crime, it's not necessarily by previous. We start to look at who you are and what kind of changes you're willing to make. And so we can put people through treatment. We can put them through intensive treatment in 6 months, less than that with follow-up and ongoing. We know it takes a year or two to actually set in. We know that there are relapse moments. So I think most of us would say for the most serious people, and we have a continuum we are continually working with. So if we're talking about the most serious people, probably a 2 to 4 year with supervision to make sure we keep them active and somebody's managing when they're learning to change the way they interact and do business is probably what we would say, depending where on the continuum and what the other issues are we're dealing with. There's a point at which supervision, other than for a small group of people that we're all very concerned about, there's a point at which the ongoing supervision begins to deteriorate, actually, the effectiveness. So we try to target that length of time. Right now, most of the people we work with are from 1 to 3 years coming out of the prisons, other than a small group that get longer periods of time. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Garrod.
Oh, thank you. The question I have is that this deals with methamphetamines, heroin, and cocaine. Do you find that there's quite a bit of difference, the problem of trying to break the addiction with the different drugs? Like, just from my small knowledge that I have, I would think cocaine would be a lot easier than, say, methamphetamine. Or do you find that all three of those are about the same?
Chair Przanski, Senator Girard, I do not want to make a statement that says I'm an expert in the area. I will tell you that what I do know is that as we work with meth addicted, I think it's fairly common knowledge nowadays that the brain rewiring has gone on, and it takes us longer, first of all, to get the brain working again so that there's clarity, and then the ongoing same kind of treatment and the cognitive work around what other choices, how do you do life differently, but the whole sensory and brain rewiring makes that probably one of the most difficult drugs to work with because of the physiological damage. I think that's why we're having so much trouble trying to address the drug effectively. We need both the time to get you squared away, but then we need the treatment that's effective with an altered awareness. I know Commissioner Nato may have, she spent some time in her role.
Chair Przanski, Senator Girard, I really would concur with that's the information that I've heard, but again, I'm not an expert either. We could certainly provide that information to you, but my understanding is that methamphetamine addicts can be successfully treated. It just takes often a bit longer than some of the other addictions.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to help Senator Girard about, well, I was going to say not last session, but the session before, and I think Senator Burdick was chair of the committee at that time. We had a presentation up in the Pendleton area, if I remember correctly, from experts on this very issue, where they had done brain scans with people who had taken methamphetamines, and they show that physiologically, it's a lot more addictive than other drugs are. It takes a lot longer to break the cycle. It eliminates people's ability to sense pleasure unless they're taking the drugs, and it takes at least 18 months to come back to normal.
I agree with that.
Any other comments, questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Good afternoon. It's an honor to be before you today. On behalf of Governor Kulongoski, I'm Joe O'Leary, the Governor's Public Safety Advisor. You'll have to excuse me. I'm starting to get a little scratchy and lose my voice. I'll be very brief. I want to interject a couple of data points that I think are very significant to the kernel that represents this concept, to the repeat property offender expansion, and to the treatment piece that is connected to the repeat property offenders. I'm going to give you three statistics: 85%, 55%, and 12%. 85%, I'm going to start with that one. That is the number or the population of the repeat property offenders that today go to DOC who are severely to moderately addicted to drugs and alcohol. Right now, 85%. 55%. That is the number of those repeat property offenders, all of them, that recidivate within 3 years of release. 55%. And the last one is 12%. 12% is the number out of that same repeat property population that receive intensive drug and alcohol treatment while they are in the custody of the State Department of Corrections. To the governor's mind, those three figures represent the policy basis for the kernel of what you are doing in this bill, Senate Bill 1087. The way to enhance public safety is both to increase accountability, enhance sentences, and specifically the repeat property offender sentences. What we found is that the repeat property offenders currently under a 13 or 19 month sentence do not spend long enough time at the Department of Corrections to actually get into and complete the Department of Corrections intensive drug and alcohol treatment program. This was the basis for why folks were talking about enhancing the repeat property offender sentence, presumptive sentence. And this is what's before you in Senate Bill 1087. And the other side of that is an enhancement to the Department of Corrections' ability to provide intensive drug and alcohol treatment for that population. If you do both, enhance the sentences and provide the additional treatment beds, the governor believes, and I believe, that you will see a change in those folks who are now cycling through and recidivating at a high rate. They will recidivate at a lower rate. They will have hope, and our communities will have hope for reduced crime and reduced victimization. The bill before you is a great framework. A good concept can always get better. That kernel that I just described to you was the kernel of House Bill 2329, which the governor, along with the district attorneys, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Partnership for Safety and Justice, Crime Victims United, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association joined together to present that concept last session. That bill passed out of the House Judiciary Committee, did not get to you because it went to Ways and Means and was in Ways and Means at adjournment. But we have added to that kernel, and we've added good things to that kernel. And we continue to partner with the district attorneys and the chiefs and the sheriffs and the Association of Oregon Counties and the community corrections directors and others to improve this concept. It's a good concept no matter what's on the ballot in November. We need to refine a couple of pieces, and I'm hopeful that we will be able to do that within the next day or so. And I can assure you that I will be working around the clock, notwithstanding my voice going out, to make that happen.
Questions for Mr. O'Leary?
Yes.
First, Senator Walker, then Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, I was struck by your percentages, and when you said only 12% get treatment, I thought, well, is that because they're not there long enough, or is that because we don't have the money? And then you answered it, because we have to have that dual investment. If you're enhancing the sentences, we've got to provide the money for the treatment. So you estimate that it'll go up from 12%. To what? What's our goal?
Senator Przanski, Senator Walker, our goal has to be high. Our goal has to be to serve all we can. We're probably not going to be able to reach that goal, obviously, and that is a goal that is dependent on funding. So that is a tough one for me to answer. But what I know is that we can do more. And if what we're talking about in this concept, as it's been discussed, is about an 80%, a significant amount of these dollars will be going toward those intensive drug and alcohol treatment beds at the Department of Corrections, what I think is that that is an excellent complement to the funding that will be going to the community corrections folks for those same purposes, but for offenders who are now in the community.
And, Mr. Chair, one final question. Am I correct that the Mannix measure didn't have any provisions for treatment at all?
Senator Przanski, Senator Walker, my understanding is consistent with that. If you're referring to Initiative Petition 40, that measure increases sentence and creates mandatory minimum sentences for individuals convicted of specific property crimes and does not include any provision for funding or provision of drug or alcohol treatment.
Okay, thank you.
Before Senator Wissett asks you a question, could you just follow up on Senator Walker's as to the plan or the procedure that the Department of Correction uses as to their risk assessment and how that will probably play into this?
Senator Przanski, the Department of Corrections, as of today and for many years, does a very comprehensive risk assessment during their 30-day intake process of every offender that comes through the Department of Corrections door. And that risk assessment does include a drug and alcohol assessment. And it is on the basis of those assessments and the aggregate data from those assessments that we know that 85% figure for the repeat property offenders.
And I'm assuming based on that is how we would, if we have to triage or prioritize based on the needs and the time and length that they'll be there for making sure the dollars are effectively and efficiently spent.
Senator Przanski, that's absolutely correct. The policy decision that's made on that is that we, the state, would like to do whatever we can to get the biggest bang for our buck. We don't have enough dollars to treat everyone, as Senator Walker's question pointed out. Even with this bill, we will not have enough money to treat everyone for whom there is a need. So we want to focus our resources on the folks that we believe are the highest risk to reoffend.
Thank you. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Mr. O'Leary, to employ evidence-based practices, we really need one more percentage data point, and that is what percentage of the 12% that do receive treatment recidivate within 3 years?
Senator Przanski, Senator Wissett, point very well taken. There is preliminary data from the Department of Corrections program, but it has not been around long enough for them to be able to give you an answer to that question. What they have said is that the results are, I'm trying to think of the exact word, very encouraging, but I would have to probably get back to you with more specific information after consulting with Max Williams as to where that is at right now.
I think that would be very useful.
I'm happy to do so. What I can, if I may follow up to that answer, when we do talk about treatment, I'm sure that I'm speaking on behalf of probably every witness that's testified before you here so far this afternoon. We're always implicit in talking about treatment. We're talking about evidence-based treatment. We're talking about things that are proven to work based on models that are proven to work. We know that not every single program can have thank you. We know that not every single program can have the gold standard double-blind testing, can afford to do that, longitudinal studies, et cetera. So we rely on other programs that have been around a long time that are applying those same principles. We rely on meta-analyses of those programs to give us the best estimate of what is proven to be effective.
One further question, Mr. O'Leary. If we don't have raw data that can be tabulated for Oregon, could you give us some example of the reduction in recidivism that has been found has resulted from the evidence-based practices that you're now following in other states?
Senator Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, I'm happy to do that. That luckily for me, there's a great report out of the Washington Institute for Public Policy that outlines several of those programs, including in-custody treatment, much like the program that we're talking about here. I'm happy to get you that information.
Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions for Mr. O'Leary? Jill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is all that I have signed up on the witness registration. I know there's a number of individuals who have walked in since. I'm not sure if there's anyone else who'd like to make comment at this time. If you would like to, please give us a sign of raising your hand or stand up and start walking forward, and we'll be glad to hear from you. Not seeing anyone eagerly running forward, I think that's going to take care of us today. In committee, what we're going to be doing, as we all know, with all the bills that we have before us in this committee and all the other committees, we have a deadline of having whatever bills are going to move forward have to be completed with all amendments adopted before moving out of this committee on Tuesday, the 12th, which is this next Tuesday. It is our next regular scheduled meeting. Oh, today's Thursday. Excuse me. That's right. We do have Friday. Yep. Don't want to forget that.
Tomorrow.
So tomorrow we will have a little better insight as to whether or not we think we need to try to schedule another meeting between Friday and Tuesday. At this point, I don't anticipate that. If it is, it would more than likely be on the Monday or an early morning meeting on Tuesday. But we will make sure all members know and we properly post if that's the case. But at this point, I expect this bill, Senate Bill 1087, to be back before us with a few other bills that will be having some amendments for consideration in a work session this next Tuesday. Any questions or comments?
Yes, Chair. If I could, I just what happened is we have two bills on tomorrow that we've already heard. They were improperly posted, so we have to bring them back again. I assume that we'll go through them even faster than we did on Tuesday. Just want to let you know, I want to let the people in the audience know there's nothing up. It's just that they're improperly posted, and to make sure we follow the proper procedure, they're back again tomorrow.
All right, so just since this is new to the chair, I'm assuming what you're saying is they weren't properly posted when we heard them first time.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We had them on the as an LC. For some reason, they were not flipped over to the bill number, and we were told by the Secretary of the Senate that we need to do it with the bill number. They're being brought back.
All right, and what the chair will be doing, I believe this is permitted under our rules. The testimony that we have taken on all of those bills will, in fact, be incorporated and adopted into the record when we have them back before us, so we don't have to tax those who have already given testimony, and that will just become part of the record for each of the bills as they will be presented tomorrow.
That's correct.
Sure. All righty, with that, thank you very much, and we're adjourned.